For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show that used to be recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden. I'm your host, Red Sale, broadcasting from the broom cupboard.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, once again recording in the bedroom. And coming up in today's show,
Ellen Alpston will introduce us to Tsarina, the most powerful woman that history ever forgot.
Author Gary Bridson Daly will tell us about The Last Heroes, voices of British and Commonwealth veterans.
And children's author L.D. Lipinski will introduce us to the Strange Worlds Travel Agency.
That's all coming up in today's Read On.
She is, in all likelihood, the most powerful woman that history ever forgot. And Catherine I of Russia has a rags-to-riches story that makes Cinderella look like child's play. Now, in her dazzling debut novel, Tsarina, author Ellen Alpston turns the spotlight back onto Catherine I and her extraordinary life. Ellen Alpston, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, for those who haven't yet picked up a copy of Tsarina, give us a quick synopsis.
Tsarina is my debut novel about Catherine I of Russia, and that is not Catherine the Great, I hasten to say. And here's my elevator pitch. Basically, Tsarina tells a story from serf to empress and from backward nation to superpower. And Tsarina tells for the first time ever the incredible story of the Russian Empress Catherine I. She was born as Martha, an illegitimate, illiterate daughter of a Baltic serf, and then captured at the heart of one of the most powerful men in Russian history, Peter the Great. So at his death, she might seize his throne and become the first ever woman to rule Russia. And that's exactly where my novel starts, because Peter the Great died without designating an heir for his empire, which in those days was the largest and wealthiest realm on earth. So Tsarina is really the most extraordinary rags-to-riches tale. It's a story of sex, power, and ruthlessness. Marta really experiences every humiliation and almost death until destiny sends her into the arms of Peter the Great, and she drinks with him, she makes him laugh and cry. She follows him in battle and gives him a dozen children, only to see most of them die. She fights for him, loves him, hates him, endures his mistresses, saves him, and witnesses many a brutal execution that is supposed to scare her witless. But Marta, or Catherine, is made of sterner stuff and rises from the dirt to the most dizzying heights of power. And Tsarina is also the story of the birth of a modern Russia, of a rising empire and turmoil and change, of the madness of war and the reckless brutality of a monarchy set against the colourful backdrop of the wild and passionate world of 18th century Russia, where really nothing is as abundant and worthless as human life.
It is the most extraordinary story. It's Cinderella meets Game of Thrones. And I was astounded that it's never been told in its entirety before.
Yes, I know. I think I was just incredibly lucky. Or by now, you know, after all the research I've done and after writing this book, which made on Sunday called a sort of a sprawling canvas and a huge cast, I almost feel that I was destined to find her in quotation marks. And I was destined to write this book. And I liken Catherine I almost to Tutankhamun. She was always there. But the tsars before her and after her, and especially the turmoil and chaos in Russia that followed Peter the Great's death, made her slip into the shadows. So, as I said, Catherine I is not Catherine the Great, but she set the scene for everything that was to follow politically, a century of unprecedented female reign in Russia. I found her when I read a book called Germans and Russians by author Leo Sievers, which charts the very varied millennial history of these two people. And despite terrible tragedies and two horrendous wars, there is a deep, a mutual fascination for each other. And one chapter in this book was devoted to Catherine I because she was born a German Baltic serf girl who only through the Great Northern War, where Russia and Sweden struggled for the supremacy in the Baltics, became a prisoner of war ended up in the Russian camp, was noticed by a general, and eventually was noticed by the Tsar. So this is how I found my Catherine. And when I had matured enough to really write, after dabbling a bit and dreaming of being an author, I realized that, amazingly enough, there was no book about her, no thesis, no biography, no novel, no nothing. And that was really my starting point, Red.
And as you say, she was the illegitimate daughter of peasants in, I think, what's now modern-day Latvia, and had a pretty horrendous life. She was bought and sold and molested and had to fend for herself, and has a terrible secret that she's trying to cover up.
Yes, exactly. So in the first 200 pages, I chart her life, the life of a surf girl. A lot of reviewers have actually told me that they appreciated these 200 pages most, because history, of course, we always look always at the kings and queens, but history is not only about the lives of kings and queens, but of all the people, you know, who toiled every day and made basically the world go around and made things happen. And equally, if you look at recent successes, even at Downton Abbey, I think without the drama below the stairs, we wouldn't have been as fascinated with the life of the Crawleys. So her first 200 pages, where she really suffers every hardship, every humiliation, she cheats death at every turn, make for the most interesting read. And the reader asks himself all the time, how on earth is she going to meet the Tsar, let alone win his heart? And yes, there is a crime happening, but after this night of violence, it's actually her who emerges triumphant and not the person who inflicts all these terrible things on her. So it's a very strong message, I think, that is sent.
And of course, if we don't know how low she has been, we've got no sense of how high she has risen. And we shouldn't really be surprised that the Tsar might marry a peasant girl. He was a great reformer, Peter I, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a great reformer. And you are right, Red. It's a very interesting aspect of Peter the Great's personality that he, who was born into the highest station and as an absolute ruler eventually of, as I say, the world's largest and wealthiest realm, was actually a man of very simple tastes. So he rose at 4 o'clock in the morning. He would start writing his letters, sending them off in all corners of his empire, scolding his son for not studying hard enough, kicking his generals to conquer more, telling his foreign agents to pay architects and artists more money to come to Russia and fulfill his dreams, especially, interestingly enough, after he had traveled to London. And Peter the Great was equally a man who loved turning the world on its head. So perhaps even Catherine, whom he met as a washerwoman and a prisoner of war in a camp, was the ultimate expression of his desire to turn the world upside down. But of course, one has to see that she was a pretty stunning woman. Not necessarily physically, interestingly enough. If we look at her portraits today, we might actually struggle to see her appeal. It's a very soft, sweet, pretty face, blue eyes, soft mouth that likes laughing. Her eyes sparkle with mischief and certainly a very good practical sense of humor, which they shared. But she's not that you say, oh, wow, here comes Cindy Crawford. I think her strength was of a different kind altogether. A contemporary observer wrote, she is not beautiful, but she is as warm as an animal. So she definitely showed huge sex appeal, which of course counted for something. And she was as strong as a horse. And she was the only one who dared approaching Peter the Great when he has his epileptic fits, because he suffered from epilepsy ever since half his family had been slaughtered in front of his eyes when he was 8 years old. So she would just go up to him, grab his head, even though he stood 7 feet tall in his boots, and would just hold his head into her cleavage, forcing him down, and he would breathe in her warmth, that warmth as warm as an animal, until he would calm. And she stood up to him even in the darkest of days, and very few people, if anybody at all, ever did that. So if she was the ultimate expression of his desire to turn the world upside down, there were equally very real reasons for her becoming who she was.
And they were deeply in love. There are many letters between the two of them which have survived, aren't there?
Yes, they were great lovers. So they were great friends and great lovers. They had, in a way, a very modern relationship, despite him being an absolute ruler and her, in the beginning, a serf girl. He all the time wrote letters to her, which were read to her because she stayed illiterate to the end of her days, even when she later ruled Russia. And she dictated answers right back. And it's very everyday things, you know. He says, oh, my porridge is always cold and my socks have holes because you're not there to darn them. And yesterday a soldier got so drunk that he fell off the roof and almost suffocated in the snow. It would have been much funnier if you had been with me. He equally says, the nights are so white. Why are you not with me? I want to have another baby. So they're well and truly a couple. And they were well and truly in love for 20 years, for the time of their life together.
As you said, though this all happened 200 years ago, it really is the foundation of modern Russia.
Yes, that's so much of what we marvel at in Russia today was already present back then. Sort of these incredible contrasts and the Slavic soul that are just casually combined of absolute callous cruelty and the deepest empathy, distrust towards everything foreign, and an overwhelming hospitality towards strangers. Then, of course, horrid things like a passion for mock execution, and that nothing is as abundant and as worthless as human life. If the Tsar needed 100,000 forced laborers to build his city, they were there the next month, because what belonged to Russia, first and foremost, belonged to the Tsar.
And your novel is very much in the tradition of the great Russian novels, both in length and the fact that it does teem with all that Russian life, from the peasant to the most powerful person in the empire. Are you a big fan of Russian literature yourself?
I am, Red, I have to say. And if you say that Tsarina is Cinderella meets Game of Thrones, I think it's also Cinderella meets Game of Thrones meets War and Peace. So ever since I discovered Catherine the First, I went on reading about Russia, and very diverse oeuvres ranging from Tolstoy and Pushkin, Gogol and Dostoevsky, to sociological studies or biographies like Young Stalin by Simon Sebag Montefiore. So a very vast field. But the book I have to mention first and foremost was written by Professor Lindsay Hughes. It's a fabulous tome called Russia in the Time of Peter the Great. And this turned out to be my Bible as I slid deeper and deeper into the strange, shocking and sensuous world that is the Russian history and the Russian soul. And last but not least, Red, I even read Russian myths and fairy tales because they disclose so much about the mindset and the imaginary of a people. And I love it how in the end, the storyteller is rewarded by eating honey. It's a very sweet image, I think.
And the book has been brought fantastically to life as an audiobook by Anna Kripa. Did you choose her specifically? Because it's quite an undertaking to read Tsarina.
It is quite an undertaking. And actually, I was lucky enough to have been presented with Anna's clip, which we're going to listen to later, I believe, after Bolinda, my publisher, had done a very long and arduous casting. Because finding somebody who has both the soul and the stamina for this enormous story with, as I said, its sprawling canvas and the huge cast of characters is quite a rare combination. And interestingly enough, Anna is Moscow born, but British educated, but still she offered to read the book in either accent. So I had three clips to pick from, and Bolinda said, so what do you want? And it was purebred British, which we're going to hear later. It was a Baltic accent and a Russian accent. And as much as I liked it when she read in Baltic and Russian, I just felt that for an almost 600-page novel, that was a tall order for native English speakers to have to listen to. So in the end, we opted for the purebred British and have some characters, especially in the beginning of the book, who will speak with a Baltic accent.
He is dead. My beloved husband, the mighty Tsar of all the Russias, has died. And just in time. Moments before death came for him, Peter called for a quill and paper to be brought to him in his bedchamber in the Winter Palace. My heart almost stalled. He had not forgotten. He was going to drag me down with him. When he lost consciousness for the last time and the darkness drew him closer to its heart, the quill slipped from his fingers. Black ink splattered the soiled sheets. Time held its breath. What had the Tsar wanted to settle with that last effort of his tremendous spirit? I knew the answer. The candles in the tall candelabra filled the room with a heavy scent and an unsteady light. Their glow made shadows reel and brought the woven figures on the Flemish tapestries to life, their coarse figures showing pain and disbelief. The voices of the people who'd stood outside the door all night were drowned out by the February wind, rattling furiously at the shutters. Time spread slowly, like oil on water.
Anna Cripper, narrating Tsarina by Ellen Alpston. You have travelled with Catherine the First for many years, by the sounds of it. Has she left a large gap in your life now that the book is finished?
Yes, I have to say that I am obsessed with Catherine the First. She's really my girl, and I feel that Tsarina is written with heart blood. There's certainly a big part of my soul and myself in it. Writing it was an all-encompassing effort. I was at the time working as an anchor at Bloomberg Television. I was doing financial breakfast TV. Mostly I got up at 2 o'clock in the morning, cantered down the stairs to have my car waiting for me that would take me to the studio. At some point, actually, my neighbors downstairs thought I was working as a hooker or the pole dancer because they always had me at 2 o'clock in the morning leaving the house. And then I came home at noon and slept for 2 or 3 hours, went for a run, and then was fresh enough to start writing. I wrote until 9 o'clock in the evening and then went to bed again. So that was a very stringent life. And at the end, when I had finished writing the book and the editing started, it really ground me down. I suffered from anxiety and depression and I could not sleep anymore. So I needed to take a good step back. But Catherine the First World has so captured me that I have now finished penning the sequel, which is at the moment with my agent and then with my editors. And I'm equally planning already for a third book in the series. So I'm not going to leave Russia anytime soon.
Fantastic. She continues to leave a great legacy. For you, apart from the novels, what is her greatest legacy?
In Russia, her legacy was, first of all, that the 2 years of her rule were 2 years of peace and prosperity, which is relatively rare in that empire. But other than that, she, of course, coined the idea that a woman can rule. Peter the Great had crowned her as his consort, and when he died, she seized the crown. And as such, the idea of female reign was established. And really, she opened the stage for an unprecedented century of female reign. So she was followed by her niece, Anna Ivanovna, by her daughter, Elizabeth, and finally by her grandniece-in-law, Catherine the Great, her namesake. Catherine the Great was a German princess who married to Russia and who was originally called Sophia, and who, in honor of my Catherine, was rebaptized as Catherine Alexeyevna. Nowadays, if you ask me, what is the message that a modern woman can take from this book, I would say her message is kind of eternal, because Tsarina never gives up, she never surrenders, she might go with the flow, but certainly if she stumbles and falls, she gets up, dusts herself off, sees the sunrise on another day. I equally liked her loyalty. I liked how she counted on friends and family, how she carefully fostered her friendships over her life, and how she came to rely on those people whom she had saved many, many times. So I feel there's a very strong message in there that is equally valid today.
Well, Ellen Alpston, thank you so much for introducing me and I think a very hungry world to the amazing story of Catherine I and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you so much, Red, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Tsarina by Ellen Alpston is out now in print, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books. And Ellen will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
The RNIB is committed to providing life-changing support and specialist services. Services that we know people affected by sight loss need now more than ever. But we need your help. The coronavirus outbreak represents an unprecedented situation for all of us. For RNIB, it's having a huge impact on our ability to raise the money we need to continue vital services at a time when so many of us are feeling isolated and anxious. The need for access to information and to feel socially connected is critical for all of us. With an increase in demand, we're working hard to keep vital services running so that blind and partially sighted people don't have to face this crisis alone. But we need your help. This is a time for community and coming together, and we need your support now more than ever. Please help RNIB today to support the 2 million people in the UK with sight loss, their friends, family and carers. Donate at 0330 002 0893 or use the website rnib.org.uk/urgent appeal. Thank you.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, just imagine if you could climb into your suitcase and be taken to a different world. That's the idea behind a new children's book by author L.D. Lipinski called The Strange Worlds Travel Agency. She joined me over Zoom to tell me all about it.
The Strange Worlds Travel Agency, it's for ages 9 and up, and it's about a girl called Flick who has just moved to a very small, very quiet village from the big city. She goes for a walk around trying to get her bearings and she comes across an old dusty travel agency, goes inside to take a look, and inside there's lots and lots of stacked up and really sort of abandoned looking suitcases. And one thing leads to another and she finds out that they're not just ordinary suitcases, they are magical ones, because when you open them and step inside, they take you to other worlds.
Fantastic. And are they other versions of our own world or are they very different?
Oh, there's a bit of a mixture, actually. One of the worlds she goes to is called Five Lights, and that's a little bit like ours, with some differences. There's some people who use magic spells, for instance, and stealing isn't illegal in that city. It's some people's job. They've got it. They do it as a career. other worlds are completely alien, for want of a better word. There's worlds where the trees are made out of crystal. There's worlds where there's no life at all. It's just landscape. So it really is a mixture of similar and very different worlds to ours.
And Five Lights has a problem, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Five Lights is kind of like the hub at the centre of the multiverse. It's very, very magical. But when Flick and her new friend Jonathan get there, they find some very strange things going on there. There's streets have been disappearing. There's people who have been just dropping out of people's circles entirely. They can't find them. There's strange things going on with the weather. And it's up to Flick and Jonathan to find out why.
And this starts a long quest that takes them to many different worlds. And it's the first book in a series, I believe.
It is, yes. We've just announced the title for the second one. That's going to be called The Strange Worlds Travel Agency, The Edge of the Ocean, and that's coming out next year. And then there's a third book the year after that, so it's ongoing. It's definitely the first of many. The story doesn't end at the end of this first book.
There have always been places in our world where magic gathers. You can see it if you look close enough. You might see an ancient horse and cart passing down a modern high street, or a cobbled alleyway that people walk into, but never out of. Now and again, you might see it in a person, Someone who looks like they've stepped straight out of an old photograph. Or perhaps someone whose bag seems to hover off the ground catches your eye in a coffee shop. And when you look again, they and their bag have disappeared. And occasionally, you see magic in shops. Squashed between brand-name stores and fancy displays, the shops soaked in magic are never eye-catching or ostentatious. Their windows are stained with dirt and dust, and sometimes their signs have peeled away so much that it looks as though ghost letters are trying to work their way through. Magic does not wish to be noticed, you see, and most people are happy to pretend it does not exist.
Abigail Hardiman narrating The Strange Worlds Travel Agency, written by my guest, L.D. Lipinski.
It's a fantastic concept. Where did it come from?
I'm going to be a really annoying person who says, I don't know. It literally came to me out of the blue. I was washing my hair, of all things, and suddenly the travel agency and the suitcases just popped into my head, and I had to dive out of the bathroom like some sort of mad creature, throwing myself into the office. I hadn't even got dry and wrote the first 10,000 words that morning. It just popped into my head like no idea I've ever had before.
And I can hear the excitement in your voice. Presumably it was great fun to write.
It was amazing fun to write, yeah. But it was very quick as well. It really just poured out. Yeah, and writing the second one as well was really exciting. It's as though the series is a massive book that's been chopped into little chunks. So I get to enjoy myself writing each chunk instead of worrying about having to write a massive book all in one go.
Can you describe the cover of the book for blind and partially sighted listeners who might not be able to see it?
The cover has a open suitcase on the front, and there is a girl who is falling into the suitcase. She's swishing around the page and she's headed towards the suitcase as if she's going to fly inside it. And coming out of the suitcase is a hand reaching out as if to say, come into this suitcase with me. Flick has brown hair and she is 12 years old. And at the top of the book cover is a big red sign, and in gold letters it says The Strange Worlds Travel Agency, which is the same sign that is above the shop in the book.
I know that it's being simultaneously published in print and audio, and you have a rather wonderful narrator.
I do. It's Abigail Hardiman who's doing the narration. She's absolutely fantastic. I can't tell you how pleased I am that you've not got to suffer through me narrating the whole thing. She really is brilliant. I'm so pleased and proud to have her doing the narration.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I'd never used to be. I suffer quite poorly with concentrating on things that are delivered audibly. Unfortunately, I'm a much more visual person in general, and I'd never really listened to a great many audiobooks until I just finished reading La Belle Sauvage, the first book in the Book of Dust trilogy, and I was absolutely obsessed with it. And I was walking through my local library with a tote bag with the book cover on the front, and the librarian bustled up to me and said, have you seen, we've just got the audiobook of this in. And I felt like saying, well, I don't really read audiobooks. But she seemed so enthusiastic that I took it home anyway and sat and listened to it. And then it was like an epiphany, like I have been missing out on so much good storytelling. I'd forgotten how nice it is to be read to. And now I'm such a fan.
Yes, and more people, I think, are finding that audiobooks are terrific companions during these times of lockdown. And of course, the idea of climbing into a suitcase and being whisked away to different worlds has never been so tempting. It's strange timing for your publication, but I'm sure thousands of children will love travelling with the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's something even my anxiety didn't anticipate, having my debut book come out during a global pandemic. And I do hope that children and readers do use it as an escapism and do jump into other worlds with the book. Escapism in stories and novels has always been the big selling point for me, whether that's in books or video games or TV. Anything to take me away from current affairs in general has always been what I've looked for in stories. And as you say, I think now more than ever, getting away from what's going on is going to be really important.
Well, I like to finish my interviews by asking my guests to tell me about the books of their life. So was there a book that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I must have read hundreds and hundreds of books as a young person. I think what I'll always go back to is Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials. I've read my copy of Northern Lights so much that the cover is hanging off now. And I was lucky enough to meet Philip a few years ago and gave him an incredibly tatty copy and asked him to sign it. And he seemed quite amused by the fact that it was on its last legs. So yeah, definitely Northern Lights and the rest of the His Dark Materials trilogy, that really made me think that I perhaps could do that. I wanted to be an author properly. I wanted to make other worlds and have people read about them.
Lyra and her demon moved through the darkening hall, taking care to keep to one side, out of sight of the kitchen. The three great tables that ran the length of the hall were laid already, the silver and the glass catching what little light there was, and the long benches were pulled out ready for the guests. Portraits of former masters hung high up in the gloom along the walls. Lyra reached the dais and looked back at the open kitchen door and, seeing no one, stepped up beside the high table. The places here were laid with gold, not silver, and the 14 seats were not oak benches but mahogany chairs with velvet cushions. Lyra stopped beside the master's chair and flicked the biggest glass gently with a fingernail. The sound rang clearly through the hall. "You're not taking this seriously," whispered her demon. "Behave yourself." Her demon's name was Pantalaimon, and he was currently in the form of a moth, a dark brown one, so as not to show up in the darkness of the hall. "They're making too much noise to hear from the kitchen," Lyra whispered back, "and the steward doesn't come in till the first bell. Stop fussing." But she put her palm over the ringing crystal anyway, and Pantalaimon fluttered ahead and through the slightly open door of the retiring room at the other end of the dais. After a moment, he appeared again. "There's no one there," he whispered, "but we must be quick."
All of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials novels are available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including this version of Northern Lights, narrated by David Thorpe, which is TB13475.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I have a bit of a tradition every summer, and I'm looking forward to it, especially this year. I always read Gerald Durrell's My Family and Other Animals every single summer. It's just such a comforting read, the mixture of natural history and the drama that goes on with his family. And I know it's really fictionalised and a lot of it actually never happened, but it just seems so peaceful and funny, all living together in Corfu. It's just a real comfort read for me. I read it every year.
As the days passed, I came gradually to understand them. What had first been a confused babble became a series of recognisable separate sounds. Then suddenly these took on meaning, and slowly and haltingly I started to use them myself. Then I took my newly acquired words and strung them into ungrammatical and stumbling sentences. Our neighbours were delighted, as though I'd conferred some delicate compliment by trying to learn their language. They would lean over the hedge, their faces screwed up with concentration, as I groped my way through a greeting or a simple remark, and when I had successfully concluded, they would beam at me, nodding and smiling, and clap their hands. By degrees, I learnt their names, who was related to whom, which were married and which hoped to be, and other details. I learned where their little cottages were among the olive groves, and should Roger and I chance to pass that way, the entire family, vociferous and pleased, would tumble out to greet us, to bring a chair, so that I might sit under their vine and eat some fruit with them. Gradually the magic of the island settled over us as gently and clingingly as pollen. Each day had a tranquillity, a timelessness about it, so that you wished it would never end. But then the dark skin of night would peel off, and there would be a fresh day waiting for us, glossy and colourful as a child's transfer, and with the same tinge of reality.
Nigel Davenport narrating My Family and Other Animals by Gerald Durrell, which is TB704189.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I am currently reading Frances Harding's Deep Light, and it's absolutely incredible. I'm really jealous that I didn't actually write it. It's the sort of book that I keep putting down and going, I cannot believe I haven't written this. I'm so jealous that she's come up with this world. It's really, really incredible. It's about an underwater society and secrets and boys having adventures. And it's utterly fabulous. She's a wonderful writer. She's who I want to be when I grow up.
Are you sure this is safe? Asked the visiting merchant, struggling up the ladder that scaled the makeshift wooden tower. I thought you'd arrange me a place on one of those boats. All the boats are full, Hark told him glibly as he clambered up behind him. The governor and his friends and all the rich men who paid for the expedition and their families, they took all the seats. No room left. For all he knew, this might even be true. He hadn't actually checked. Besides, seats in those boats cost more than your eyes. This is a tenth of the price, and the view is better. By the time they reached the top, the merchant was out of breath and patting his face with a handkerchief. The man who owned the rickety tower guided the merchant and Hark to two cramped and precarious seats and took payment for both from the merchant. The cold wind blew, making the structure creak, and the merchant flinched, clutching his hat to his head. He didn't notice the tower owner discreetly giving Hark a wink and his commission.
Joshua Akehurst narrating Deep Light by Frances Harding, which is out now wherever you download your audiobooks.
LD Lipinski, thank you so much for introducing us to the Strange Worlds Travel Agency and for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
The Strange Worlds Travel Agency by LD Lipinski is out now in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Recently, it was the 75th anniversary of VE Day. And over on our sister show, Talking Books, we're playing The Last Heroes, voices of British and Commonwealth veterans. It was written by author Gary Bridston Daly. And here's Red Sail with more.
The book gives voice to British and Commonwealth veterans of World War II. The last heroes who remember the conflict firsthand. Here's author Gary Bridston Daly to tell us more.
The idea of it was while I was actually at sea working on cruise ships, and I have to know a lot of history about the places we were going to and the countries that we were visiting in order to do seminars and run tours. So history was predominantly a part of my job and also been a very strong personal interest from as long as I can remember, especially that of World War II. And I was very fortunate to work in places such as Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, to do North Africa, Egypt, Alamein battlefields tours, to do tours in Normandy at the five beaches of the D-Day landings, various other places as well, German fortifications in Jersey, and so on. When I was doing it, I was very fortunate with guests on board and people I met in those places. I started to meet veterans who were back there visiting at that time as well. So there we were to be able to give the tours, give the history to others. And then we were meeting people who were really there and were in what we were talking about. Momentous moments in World War II and obviously world history. As a result of that, I had the idea to come home when I'd finished my last contract on board ship with a view to actually finding and interviewing veterans of all services and all backgrounds to try and put together enough material to have these incredible and very important experiences and memories and historical narratives to put into a book. That's what I forged into what has now become the Debt of Gratitude project, of which A Debt of Gratitude to the Last Heroes is the first book and the book that you've recorded here for the RNIB. And I'm presently at home, actually use the rest of the interviews that I've done, which are over 100, to write my second book, which I'm undertaking right now.
And you have a foreword by a very special veteran.
Absolutely. And that lovely, lovely national treasure is Dame Vera Lynn. And I'm privileged to have her do the foreword for my book and also the up and coming second edition of this book, which you've recorded for our listeners, is coming out in time for the big VE Day 75. And Dame Vera has again very kindly done a little something for the front of the book in this particular case, along with what will already be there with her foreword. So to have her on board, being such a huge World War II personality figure, superstar in a sense, as well as national treasure, is just incredible. And she totally validates the work I'm doing to honour service veterans, because she herself has always been doing very similar from World War II, when she was out there in the front with the troops, not far from the front line, her life at risk, through to her charity work to this very day at her incredible 103 years of age.
Now, another familiar name from the Second World War is the Dambusters, and you were lucky enough to speak to one of the last survivors of that raid, whose story appears in the book.
Yes, when I interviewed him, that's George Johnny Johnson, he was one of the last Dambusters. He's now the last British Dambuster. So to be able to go and interview him in his home, it was a wonderful experience to actually be sat with the last British Dambuster, 617 Squadron, Operation Chastise. What a superstar amongst veterans, and what a wonderful man. Very calm, very humble, very giving, and it was just another one of those wonderful experiences, and a great name and a great privilege to have him in the book and have interviewed him and hear him talking to me. And I have to pinch myself sometimes. I'm talking to the last British Dambuster. There's a picture of his Lancaster, T for Tommy, dropping the Barnes-Wallace bouncing bomb, the upkeep. And as I'm looking at this picture, he's there in my ear. It's just like the history's real. It's tangible, it's incredible, and it's an honour to know him. Yeah, brilliant to have him in the book.
And as you mentioned at the beginning, not all the veterans you interviewed did things that made front page news. You also recognised the contribution that was made by people who were building ships and planes for the war effort. And I believe there's a very special riveter who appears in the book.
Yes, her name is Susan Jones, a.k.a. Rosie the Riveter, and she worked at Avro's building the Lancasters here in Manchester, and she was known to be the fastest riveter on her night shift, and she could do, apparently, between 50, 60 rivets per minute. Obviously, over a 12-hour shift, you wouldn't be doing that consistently, but she could do it for long periods of time. And when she was in a film with Ewan McGregor, like a documentary film called The Bomber Boys some years ago, quite funny that she was showing her riveting skills, and Ewan was asking, "Well, what are you doing and how did you do it?" She explained that to him, and there he is, Mr. Famous Celebrity, and he said, "Right, well, I'll give this a go then." He picked up the riveting gun, fired a rivet in, and it went in the wrong angle and got stuck. She promptly stepped up, took the riveting gun out of his hand. You've got to remember, had not operated one for over 70 years, and whacked the following rivets in perfectly, and she was in her 90s.
A wonderful, wonderful testament.
It's in the Bomber Boys documentary. And because she's such a great character anyway, she's not with us anymore, but she's certainly always remembered. And as anyone will be, not just by family, but by being in the book, the posterity of their story is always there.
My grandfather served in the Second World War and was not particularly keen to talk about some of the experiences he'd lived through. Did you find all the veterans who you approached forthcoming, or did you have to winkle the information out of them?
So let's say about 50% of the people I've interviewed have never been interviewed before, which was a wonderful thing. It's like a double scoop. Not only do you get their story, but you're the first one ever to have recorded their story since it happened over 70 years ago. And it was amazing to actually have done that and got that from them. And though the other extreme was people, for example, like Johnny Johnson, who's been interviewed squillions of times, but everyone is different. And some found it harder to talk about when they came to it than others. For others, it was just, well, this is what happened, and it was matter of fact. And some actually who hadn't spoken about a particular aspect of it or the story, if say it led off into something else, maybe the loss of friends in battle that they saw, the maiming or injury of people they cared about, the stress that comes with all those things, and even a touch of PTSD that we might say these days. It's all in the mix. And yes, there were some moments from the lightest thing where someone had to stop because obviously they were quite moved, through to one particular gentleman who essentially, he was RAF as well, and he got shot down and all sorts of things he witnessed. He was moved to crying, and it was very unexpected for him and for me. But these are the things that happen, because yes, they may be over 70 plus years ago these things happen, but when you're reliving them, it may as well have been yesterday, because that poignancy, that pain, those memories, they are still as fresh when you revisit them. And that's what I found with people there. So yeah, difficult one. And also on the other extreme, there's others who saw the most horrific stuff. I've interviewed D-Day veterans who sped off onto the beaches that very first morning, were only 18, 19 years old, and saw their friends around them shot to pieces and everything. Yet they can talk about it without any problem. So I think a lot of it is down to the individual and how they manage that memory and how much or how little, in some cases, pain it may bring them to actually recall it.
Did you interview any veterans through Blind Veterans UK?
Yeah, actually, two prominent ones. And funny enough, just by coincidence, they were both D-Day paratroopers. They were on opposite ends of the country, so they didn't know each other. It just happened during the interview process. The gentleman up here in Manchester was called Ray Shook, and he was a D-Day paratrooper, 6th Airborne Division. And the gentleman down south was Cyril Tasker, and he again was 6th Airborne Division, D-Day.
And they are fascinating stories, and it proves that it takes a whole population to mobilise to defeat a common enemy.
I totally agree, and there are some parallels with what's going on now. Because we have been very fortunate since World War II, as a result of the efforts and sacrifices of that generation, not to have had a major war that's impacted any generation of this country since, it means that we haven't had any kind of need or requirement to pull together as a nation or do anything similar until recently. And because of that, people reading any of this kind of history could relate to a certain degree, more some out of interest, but not on a personal level. But now a little more insight is provided, because when they're reading about the people who had to come together as a nation, do things jointly, cooperate, had to do what they literally said in wartime, keep calm and carry on. All of us are having to do that to a certain extent with this new enemy, the coronavirus. And that, in a strange yet interesting way, means that people who read this will have a certain tangible sense of what they mean when they read the words that we had to stand together as a country, as a people, to defeat a common enemy. Then it was Nazism, fascism, etc. Now it's the coronavirus.
And of course, some of the very few veterans who are still alive are leading the charge in fighting the coronavirus. I'm thinking particularly of Captain Tom Morgan.
Talk about that generation stepping up again to do their bit again for our country when it's in another hour of need. And that just shows the fortitude, the resilience, and that pure, beautiful, incredible gutsiness that that generation has. So you've got Captain Tom there and everything that he's doing, which is incredible, and the millions upon millions that he's raising for the NHS, wonderful work. You've got Dame Vera Lynn, who re-released We'll Meet Again, all money going to NHS charities as well. You have the Queen, who came and made two very passionate speeches to try and rally the nation. Such a great example to the rest of us.
And to mark the 75th anniversary of VE Day, you and your publisher have very kindly arranged for R&IB Connect Radio to serialise The Last Heroes as a daily show on the station.
Yes, and that's wonderful. It's great to be able to do my bit, my part, through something I can give, which is my creation of my work and my book, in the hope that it will continue in this particular way to benefit others.
Gary Britton-Daly, thank you so much for reminding us of the selfless contribution made by so many British and Commonwealth subjects during the Second World War and of their living history through The Last Heroes. The Last Heroes by Gary Britton-Daly is available as TB25018. It's narrated by Philip Bretherton. Now it's back to Ellen Alpston for the books of her life. So, Ellen, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, there was actually. I was born in the highlands of northern Kenya at the foot of mystical Mount Elgon, where life glows in technicolor, and in Africa, a tall tale is always appreciated, be it in the tribal tradition where myths and legends are passed on orally, or around the campfire on safari or during a long evening when the rains have come. My father was a vet, my mother taught at a local school. We had no TV, but a big garden and plenty of pets, amongst them, at times, a wounded serval cat, a grumpy polo pony called Calypso, and even a baby crocodile. And I had lots of books. So I read, I wrote diary, recording things like, this morning there was a 9-foot python curled up in the tree above my swing. And once a month, I would receive a book parcel from my godmother in Germany. And the book that touched me most was The Brothers Lionheart by Astrid Lindgren. She's better known for her Pippi Longstocking character, but The Brothers Lionheart is the most incredibly spiritual and soulful book about the fight of these two brothers who live in a sort of afterworld. It's about good against evil and life against death. And profoundly touching. My 10-year-old son, Gustav, recently finished it. And once he had done so, he just came into my study for a long and silent hug because he was so touched by it. And if I ever write something similar, I'm a happy woman indeed.
Unfortunately, we couldn't find any English language versions of The Brothers Lionheart. But other books by Astrid Lindgren are available from the R&IB library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I think this has to be Gone with the Wind. I've read that 5 or 6 times. I've seen it 5 or 6 times in the cinema as a teenager. You know, in the afternoon show when they would bring basically these big Hollywood films. And I think that definitely is huge scope. And the vast amount of people taking part of it, as well as the historic importance of the themes and the events covered, implicitly inspired me to write Arena. And equally, its themes are eternal. War and peace, love and hate. And also, if Scarlett O'Hara is not always palatable, her voice in the book is unfailingly authentic. And that too reminds me of my Catherine in Serena. She rings 100% true, whatever she does.
Scarlett O'Hara was not beautiful, but men seldom realized it when caught by her charm, as the Tarleton twins were. In her face were too sharply blended the delicate features of her mother, a coast aristocrat of French descent, and the heavy ones of her florid Irish father. But it was an arresting face, pointed of chin, square of jaw. Her eyes were pale green without a touch of hazel, starred with bristly black lashes and slightly tilted at the ends. Above them, her thick black brows slanted upward, cutting a startling oblique line in her magnolia white skin. That skin so prized by southern women, and so carefully guarded with bonnets, veils, and mittens against hot Georgia suns. Seated with Stuart and Brent Tarleton, in the cool shade of the porch of Tara, her father's plantation, That bright April afternoon of 1861, she made a pretty picture. Her new green-flowered muslin dress spread its 12 yards of billowing material over her hoops and exactly matched the flat-heeled green Morocco slippers her father had recently brought her from Atlanta. The dress set off to perfection the 17-inch waist, the smallest in three counties, and the tightly fitting basque showed breasts well matured for her 16 years. But for all the modesty of her spreading skirts, the demureness of hair netted smoothly into a chignon, and the quietness of small white hands folded in her lap, her true self was poorly concealed. The green eyes in the carefully sweet face were turbulent, willful, lusty with life, distinctly at variance with her decorous demeanor. Her manners had been imposed upon her by her mother's gentle admonitions and the sterner discipline of her mammy. Her eyes were her own.
Liza Ross narrating Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, which is TB15050. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
This might be A Collector of Worlds by author Ilya Troyanov. And it actually tells about the travels and adventures of Sir Richard Burton, who's not the actor, but a Victorian adventurer and explorer, who sought for the sources of the Nile, when their exact nature and location were the Victorian world's last unsolved riddle. So he disguised himself as a Muslim to participate in the Hajj, and he was a governor of Damascus later on. It's a book that's all about curiosity and the strive for knowledge and about the quest of adventures and never accepting the obvious as an answer. So I like that, especially in these disorienting days of splendid isolation. Let's call it like that, Red.
The Collector of Worlds by Ilya Troyanov is available commercially, although only in print. Ellen Alpston, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Well, I thank you. I'm absolutely honoured.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But we'll be back at the same time next week, or you can always download us as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. And if you can, rate, review, please leave us 5 stars or a nice kind word.
You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at Talking_Books.
Farewell until next week. Stay well, and don't forget to read on.